Good morning, everyone. This is Judge Flory, the presider here today with Judges Siegel and Judge Ross. Just a couple of comments. For whatever reason, we seem to be having a little bit of audio issue this morning. So make sure if you lose your audio connection, I'll be watching you on the screen. Gesture to me so that I can understand if you're not hearing the court or your co-counsel or opposing counsel here. Other than that, well, we'll follow our normal rules with the court. It works best if you do remain muted when you're not speaking, that we're therefore we're not picking up the shuffling of papers. As you know, and I'll say this for the benefit of any spectators, our rules do prohibit the recording of these proceedings. The court does make a recording, and we will post that as we would in our normal course of business, but otherwise there should be no other recording of the proceedings here today. This case is State of Minnesota versus Gabriel Edward Towne, court file 820-0073. Both parties here will have 15 minutes for their principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if they wish. Please begin your arguments by identifying yourselves for our record. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Catherine Middlebrook, representing the appellant Gabriel Towne. Appellant was convicted of first degree aggravated robbery by his guilty plea, and he was sentenced to prison for 58 months. The issue presented to this court involves his plea agreement and whether there was a breach when the district court sentenced him to a term that was above the agreed upon range from the plea agreement. Now, the state claims that appellant's plea agreement was conditional, and we would agree that it was conditional, but not in the same way that the state does. There were really two parts to this agreement. The first part was that appellant had agreed to testify truthfully at the co-defendant's trial. And the second part was that the state agreed that he would receive a sentencing departure. And they specifically stated a range that went from a dispositional departure, which was probation, where it would be 365 days in jail, and then probation, up to a durational downward departure from the presumptive sentence. So that range was put into the plea agreement, and the district court failed to follow that. First of all, with regard to the claim that the state made that appellant breached the plea agreement, what happened here was the appellant had agreed to testify truthfully at the co-defendant's trial, and he agreed to cooperate, and he did cooperate. He gave the police a statement. He gave the prosecutor a statement before that co-defendant's trial, and he appeared to testify. He did testify, and he was asked if he could identify the co-defendant, and he could not. At that point, that trial of the co-defendant was recessed. So the state then claimed that appellant had breached the plea agreement, so the whole deal was off. And that's wrong, because first of all, it was not established that appellant testified untruthfully. What the defense attorney presented at sentencing was that appellant couldn't identify the co-defendant because of his change in appearance. And he also indicated that the appearance significantly changed with long hair and a beard, and that appellant made a mistake that he couldn't identify him. But that wasn't necessarily untruthful. At the sentencing hearing, the state made that claim, made that statement, but they didn't present any evidence to the court to determine that. And based on that, you cannot find a breach where there's no evidence to support it. In fact, the prosecutor that was at sentencing wasn't even the prosecutor from the plea agreement or from the co-defendant's trial. So the court didn't even hear from that prosecutor And as far as being untruthful, what does that mean? Does that mean that he has to, commit perjury? Does that mean that he has to tell a complete different, testify completely different than what he did at his plea hearing or in his statements to the police? And it's just, it's a term that, or a condition that's really subjective and almost impossible to prove that under these circumstances. So overall, there was no breach by appellant of the plea agreement in the first place. With regard to the, the district court obviously found that the appellant had testified untruthfully, but there's a problem with that because that district court was acting as a witness. It was the same judge that was at the co-defendant's trial and came in basically as a witness for the state to say that appellant had breached the plea agreement and provided untruthful testimony. That raises a Dorsey issue where it's relying on evidence that's outside of the record. And again, that the state or that the judge then became an impartial fact finder. So based on that, there was no breach by appellant. But even if the court accepts that the district court found that there was the breach, that he didn't testify truthfully, the second part of this plea agreement was a range. It was a sentencing range. And where there is a sentencing range that's not followed from a plea agreement and the court doesn't follow it, that makes the sentence unlawful and the appellant was never given the opportunity to withdraw his plea. Instead, the judge imposed a sentence outside of that range.
So Ms. Middlebrook, I'm having hard time understanding why there would be part of the agreement that someone would testify truthfully, but if they don't, they still are entitled to a range of departure. I'm not understanding that part of the argument. It seems to me that the two conditions are intertwined one with the other. And so it seems to depend on whether or not the determination of untruthful testimony is supported or not. You can clarify that for me if you could, but I guess I understand there's two parts to it, but they certainly seem to be dependent on one another.
Yes, Your Honor, if I can clarify that, the sentence that was stated was a range, and it doesn't make any sense that there was that range for a sentence agreement when appellant was pleading guilty to the most serious charge, the aggravated robbery. And the state's, I agree there is it's a bit murky on what exactly the terms were. And the defense attorney even told appellant at the plea hearing, this is complicated because there's going to be a departure, but we just don't know what it's going to be yet. So if you look at everything that was said and the entire record and what's told to appellant, it's that sentencing range was agreed upon, and it didn't make any sense if the whole deal was going to be off if the defendant didn't testify truthfully. And in fact, appellant is never told by the state, by his attorney, or by the district court that if he doesn't testify truthfully, or if he decides he can't even testify at all at the co-defendant's trial, that the whole plea deal is off. And then the sentence is basically up to the judge. It would be like a straight plea. He's never told that at any time in any of these hearings at all. And in fact, the range, if you adopt what the state says and that this was all conditional, it doesn't make any sense because why was there a range who is going to decide where in that range he fell? If, you know, is he supposed to testify, you know, perfectly well, and then he gets the dispositional probationary sentence? Or if the state didn't really like how he testified, he get something else in that range? It doesn't make any sense. So the top of that range is the equivalent of a cap. And that makes sense for a plea agreement where the defendant is giving up all these rights and agreeing to a condition that's actually pretty scary and pretty onerous. And he makes that agreement and wants to cooperate, does everything to cooperate with the state. And the fact that he couldn't identify the co-defendant, that's really on the state, because the state has an obligation to prepare their witnesses. And as the defense attorney told the district court, that there was no preparation. He was never shown a picture. He was never asked, you know, shown a more recent picture or prepared in the way that he should have been if they really wanted that in-court identification.
Was there evidence in the record that the appellant had known the co-defendant for 10 years?
That was what the testimony was. He'd known him a long time, but he also hadn't seen him for over 2 years. And the co-defendant had changed his appearance quite a bit. You know, you're the witness, they're in the courtroom, things are a lot different. And, you know, the reality is that the state, even the defense attorney said, the state kind of pulled the plug really fast here. There was nothing that, you know, he didn't do any rehabilitation. He didn't, you know, ask more questions to the appellant. And appellant, you know, consistent with his plea agreement, he admitted the facts of the offense and that he was with the co-defendant. He told the police the same thing.
I'm sorry, if I could just interrupt here. So what is the remedy then, and why? I mean, we remand it for an evidentiary hearing on whether your client testified truthfully. Do we leave it to the discretion of the district court and just say, you know, if we agree with you know, one or more parts of your argument? I don't want to do a multi-part question, but I will tell you the other part of my question is, or a separate question, is if your client was sentenced to 1 month less than the presumptive range, would that be consistent with the plea agreement?
Okay, so I'll try to answer the questions as you asked them. So first of all, the remedy here is obviously this court can remand if they want more facts on the record for an evidentiary hearing. That's totally within the court's authority here. As far as the remedy for what happened and the plea agreement not being followed, the court can either order specific performance or that appellant should be allowed to withdraw his plea. And to remand for the district court to decide that. And either one of those remedies are available based on the court's precedent. So the second question that...
I'm sorry, I was a little lost in your answer. Are you suggesting that we remand for the district court to decide whether to specifically perform or allow the withdrawal, or that this court should direct the district court either way?
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should remand and direct the court to either sentence him according to the plea agreement or to allow him to withdraw the plea. With regard to Chief Justice Siegel's question on 1 month less, I mean, obviously that would be a downward departure. It seems pretty unfair under all the circumstances. It seems like that's, you know, that would be sort of vindictive to to Mr. Towne. And in that situation, then I do think that he probably would want to withdraw his plea. And, but, you know, that's the downward departure, I think, has to be something that's meaningful. And if, you know, you look at the whole case under fairness, you know, Mr. Town pled guilty, agreed to cooperate, did cooperate with the police, did cooperate with the state. And again, I think it's on the state for not properly preparing him for that trial. And it also is this idea that, you know, testifying truthfully, what exactly does that mean? And it's the case law is very, very clear that when you have any type of conditional plea agreement, whatever the conditions are, it needs to be clear and express so that everybody understands it, particularly the defendant. And all of the cases that were cited by the state, all of those cases where there's these conditional plea agreements, they all are very clear on what the contingency is. That if, for instance, if the defendant is ordered to, is released to reappear for sentencing, and he doesn't do that, he's going to get the higher sentence, or the plea agreement is off, or the plea deal is off. And that's what all of those cases stand for. And the courts consistently held that. And that's why it's so important that those conditions be really clear and made known to the defendant so he knows what the consequences are if he fails the condition. And I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Middlebrook. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brennan Lee. I'm a certified student attorney appearing under the supervision of Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. The crux of this issue is simply whether this plea deal was an unqualified promise from the state or a valid conditional plea. And here, this was a valid conditional plea agreement. The agreement appellant entered into was conditioned on his truthful testimony at his co-defendant's trial. In failing to provide truthful testimony at his co-defendant's trial, appellant breached the plea agreement and was not entitled to specific performance of the agreement by the state. It is the position of the state, and the record shows, and the district court found, that the appellant had violated the conditional term of his plea agreement by failing to provide truthful testimony at his co-defendant's trial.
Who decides that, Mr. Lee, whether it was truthful or not, and how is it decided? Is there some authority out there to guide the court on how that determination is made? Does there need to be a evidentiary hearing? Can the trial court decide that based upon its observations in the trial? What guidance do we have as an appellate court as to how that determination should be made?
That would be a fact issue that this appellate court would review for clear error. The terms of an agreement are reviewed for clear error as fact issues. And in this case, one of the terms was the truthful testimony. Appellant cites State v. Dorsey to assert that the trial court judge was behaving as a witness in this case. State v. Dorsey is differentiated here because this trial court judge was acting in her duties both at the co-defendant's trial and at this plea agreement and at sentencing. In Dorsey, the judge went and conducted an extrajudicial fact-finding mission. It is always the role of the judge to make a credibility determination. And in this case, the district court judge did make a credibility determination and told the appellant that she did not buy his testimony at trial. It's a unique circumstance where the district court judge was present at the co-defendant's trial and at sentencing, but it is still within the district court's right to make that credibility determination.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, the terms of a plea deal are a fact issue for the district court. Safe v. Brown stands for that. And the record here shows that the term was conditional. And there's a couple of facts that establish that. First of all, this was not the first offer from the state. The state's first offer was a 50-month bottom-of-the-box sentence without any requirement that there be truthful testimony at co-defendant's trial. The appellant accepted this offer, which was conditioned on truthful testimony. The sentencing was scheduled for after the co-defendant's trial.
Do you believe the plea agreement is ambiguous?
No, a plea agreement is based on what the parties reasonably understood the terms of the deal to be. State v. Brown.
But the agreement itself, do you believe the agreement in this case had any ambiguities?
The agreement could have been better. But
no, my question is, for the purpose of interpreting the agreement, do you believe that it was ambiguous or unambiguous?
This plea agreement was not ambiguous.
Well, if it wasn't ambiguous, then why would we look outside of the agreement to discern its meaning? Why would we concern ourselves with whether there were previous plea offers made and rejected?
You can look at the terms of the agreement, and it specifically states that it's dependent on truthful testimony.
No, but you were referring to, I think you were supporting your argument as to the meaning of the agreement based upon what prior discussions had occurred and what offers had been presented and rejected. We don't do that, do we, if the agreement that we're construing is unambiguous?
Not if it's unambiguous. If there are ambiguities found, State v. Zimmerman is a case where this court used both the trial transcripts as well as the actual term sheet that had been signed to construe what the plea agreement had actually been agreed to. And for that reason, if it is determined that this is ambiguous, both of the totality of the circumstances that led to this agreement are insightful because, again, this is what the parties reasonably believed the agreement to be.
Right. I'm just trying to get a sense of the state's argument. Is the state arguing that it's an ambiguous agreement that requires us to look into other circumstances to construe it, or that it is an unambiguous agreement and the terms are plain and discernible on the face?
There would have been no reason to include the condition of truthful testimony if not.
No, I understand your argument. I'm trying to understand now the framing of your argument. Is it the state's position that the agreement was ambiguous, is ambiguous, and therefore we should look outside of the agreement to the history of the agreement to discern its meaning? Or is the state's position that the agreement is unambiguous and we should look only to the agreement itself? I don't think you can have both.
The terms of this agreement do state that it was conditioned on the truthful testimony. However, this court does need to look to the totality of the circumstances, if only to understand what the parties reasonably understood the agreement to be.
So then your position then is, the state's position is that we have an ambiguous plea agreement.
This goes to how to reasonably understand what the parties agree.
I'm just trying to get it's a sort of a binary question. Either the state's position is that we have an ambiguous plea agreement or an unambiguous plea agreement. And because you keep directing us to the background and other circumstances outside of the agreement itself, I gather the state's position on appeal is that we have an ambiguous plea agreement.
Those circumstances only go to what the parties reasonably understood the terms of the agreement to be. The terms of the agreement do state that truthful testimony is a condition for this plea. But in order to understand what is reasonably, what the parties reasonably understood at the time, the totality does need to be included. I don't see the need for ambiguity or unambiguous in making that determination, because it's
generally understood. Generally speaking, a plea agreement is an agreement. It's a contract between the state and the defendant, and we construe agreements based upon their plain language, unless the agreement is ambiguous, in which case we look outside of the agreement. It seems like you're asking us to construe the agreement as unambiguous for part of your argument and ambiguous for another part of your argument. I'm not sure that's what we do, but if you believe that's what we should be doing, then you can direct us to the authority that supports that.
Again, I would say State v. Zimmerman shows that both of those can be used if this court does decide it to be ambiguous.
So can I ask you a little different question? No, I lost my train of thought, actually. But I'll ask you this other question, and maybe the other one will come back to me. So the on the question of remedy again. Well, no, this is what it was. Do you have any cases with that on a defendant's right to withdraw a plea where it was not absolutely, where there wasn't some clear language setting out the consequences in the plea, that if you don't do this, then the judge will sentence you in accordance with the guidelines? Because it seems like there is agreement that that language was not in this plea agreement. So do you have any case law supporting, you know, that defendant shouldn't be allowed to withdraw his plea?
I would turn back to Zimmerman in this case. At the plea hearing, the district court judge did read into the record the presumptive sentence and did note the box range prior to taking the defendant's plea. In Zimmerman, it required to resolve the ambiguity looking at the transcript and looking at the terms of the agreement itself. In this case, the agreement did not state the consequences directly within the writing of the agreement.
Well, or in the transcript, unless you read into the court's comments. I mean, the presumptive here is 58 months or whatever it is.
Well, the reason to read into the court's comments is because it does go to what the parties understood the agreement to be.
Okay.
And if prior to taking the defendant's plea, the district court judge reminded everybody in the courtroom what the presumptive sentence was, that is an indication of that the parties knew what was being agreed to.
Then again, if we do find that there is an issue, I just wanted to confirm, and that's an if, a big if, you know, not foreshadowing any decision of this panel. The state has asked this court in that case to remand for sentencing pursuant to the plea agreement. Is that right? As opposed to allowing the defendant, Mr. Town, to withdraw his plea.
If there is no conditional agreement here, then Concierge is the governing decision. And in Concierge, this court sent the case back to district court, but left the decision not with the defendant, but with the district court as to whether to accept a withdrawal or remand in accordance with the sentence.
But that seems different than what is set out in the state's brief. Because as I read the state's brief, they're saying if there is a, if you do find a problem here, then we want this remanded in accordance with the plea agreement and not.
The state does note that Concierge is the governing case law, but does also note that policy arguments would weigh in favor of sentencing in accordance with the agreement then.
Okay.
Mr. Lee, I have an additional question for you regarding ambiguity. Do you agree that if the plea agreement is ambiguous under Minnesota law, we are to resolve any ambiguities in favor of the defendant?
In the case that there is a close call, that is what the case law states. However, here it's clearly a conditional agreement. There would have been no reason to include truthful testimony as part of the agreement if that was not part of the condition. As for the assertion that truth is ambiguous, that is a determination, a credibility determination for the judge. And the truth should not be something that is construed as vague, is construed as ambiguous. It's the truth or it isn't. In this case, the district court judge made that determination that there was untruthful testimony, the appellant breached the agreement, and then sentence accordingly. And I would ask that this court affirm that district court judge's determination. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lee. Ms. Middlebrook, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I've got a few points. I would urge the court here to find that this plea agreement is ambiguous. The state cannot explain why there's a range in the sentencing. And the terms of, you know, whether it is a complete conditional plea agreement or part conditional, part qualified, or whether that sentencing term is unconditional, that there's that upper cap. As the court's questions have shown, it is ambiguous. And if the court looks outside of that and looks at the totality, everywhere else in the record supports what appellant's position is on this plea agreement.
You don't dispute that the agreement included a truthfulness component of some sort?
No, Your Honor, we do not dispute that there was that condition.
And you don't, I assume you also would agree that it's generally, when it's a matter of truthfulness, that because credibility determinations always lie with the fact finder, that if the district court, with sufficient support, finds that your client was not truthful, then that would go to whether the condition was met.
In a normal case, yes. But I think in this case, there is a real problem with that because there was no evidence presented at this sentencing hearing about whether or not appellant testified truthfully. And as I indicated before, the judge making that credibility, there was no evidence upon which to base that was part of this record. And the judge was actually acting as a witness in that situation. But outside from that, if the court decides that the judge's decision on the untruthfulness, it still doesn't mean that this plea agreement was breached and therefore all deals were off because of that sentencing condition that's also, or the sentencing term that's also in there.
Just to be, if I could push back a little bit on it, maybe you can disabuse me of my understanding of the law, which is that even if no one other than a single witness testifies, a fact finder still has the discretion to consider the testimony, at least in whole or in part, incredible. The fact finder can say, I don't need any other evidence. I've watched the demeanor of the witness. I know the circumstances of the testimony, and I find the testimony incredible. You're suggesting that there must be something more than that before a credibility determination can be sustained?
I would say in a normal case, that would be true. But here, there is this problem with the witness or the judge actually being the witness, and whether or not that is bringing in evidence that's outside of the record, I think does raise a Dorsey issue. So in a normal case, yeah, the district court would make that determination. But again, the state didn't present any evidence whatsoever. The actual prosecutor didn't even come in and explain what happened. So the burden is on the state for showing that there was a breach by appellant, and they didn't meet that burden. They didn't present that evidence. Just quickly, I also would point out that if the court looks at what was said to the appellant during the plea hearing, it's clear that the terms of that plea agreement are ambiguous, because the defense attorney says it's complicated. So does that, you know, probably equivalent of that it's, you know, it's murky, it's ambiguous. At the hearing that happened before the co-defendant's trial, the prosecutor specifically says that as he's trying to discuss what happened, you know, why it's important that appellant remain law-abiding and not pick up any new convictions, and goes to credibility for the co-defendant's trial, he says that the dispositional departure is not off the table, and that's a huge incentive. So again, it does indicate that that's what appellant was going to get if the state thought he met the condition. They don't even talk about the upper range and the cap, which again goes to that was the top of the sentence that appellant could receive no matter what. It's also really critical that appellant's never told. And if the terms are, you know, if it's a close case on ambiguity, then obviously it goes in the defendant's favor, and that's the way it has to be for plea agreements and for the whole fairness aspect of this. I see my time is up, so we would request that the court find that the district court, may I finish, Your Honor?
You may.
Yeah. We would ask that the court find that the district court sentencing Mr. Towne to 58 months in prison, which was above the agreed upon term, did violate the plea agreement, and that he should either be allowed to be resentenced to that agreement or allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I have a quick question not related to the merits of the case. My question goes to Mr. Lee. Was this your first argument, Mr. Lee?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think Ms. Middlebrook would agree that you held up well under the pressure. Nicely done.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Absolutely. Nice job.
Agreed. Thank you, Middlebrook.
I think the panel is unanimous on that issue. So anyway, we will take the matter under advisement. We appreciate the briefing and your arguments in the case, and we will issue a decision in the matter within the statutory time frame. We stand adjourned. Thank you.